From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, political writer Jonathan Alter on same-sex marriage, President Obama's political fights, and Paul Ryan's place in national politics. Then a new project works to get city residents to think about what it means to thrive here. It wasn't always an easy task.
They had some challenge to keep with the thriving and not spiral downward into discussing the challenges, the real challenges that the city faces.
Essayist Mark Segrist wonders, what's up, Milwaukee? And a museum exhibit explores the affinity between Jews and rock and roll.
Jews have always been, in one form or another, looked at as outsiders. And when you think about rock and roll heroes, they're often looked at as rebels or outsiders who are not necessarily going with the status quo.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The recent ruling overturning Wisconsin's same-sex marriage ban and the subsequent stay of that decision came as the national climate for same-sex marriage has warmed considerably. In fact, Wisconsin was just the latest in a series of states to see bans on same-sex marriage knocked down. 2 years ago, President Obama changed his public stance on same-sex marriage and changed its political dynamics for both Democrats and Republicans. That story was one of the pivotal moments at the end of Obama's first term, and it's chronicled in political writer Jonathan Alter's latest book, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies, which has just come out in paperback. The book details many of the political fights between the Obama administration and the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, from the debate over raising the debt ceiling to the standoff over the so-called grand bargain. Alter tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke that same-sex marriage allowed the president to connect better with younger voters in 2012, but he says the issue has already evolved a great deal in just a short time.
The issue has changed so fast in this country. As recently as 2004, if it were not for a series of ballot initiatives in states like Ohio that helped to turn out conservative evangelical voters who disliked gay marriage, if it were not for those ballot initiatives, those years that Karl Rove got on the ballot in those states in 2004, John Kerry would have been elected president. It was that close in Ohio, and the difference was really the evangelical voters who came out to vote against a same-sex ballot initiative. Just 8 years later, the issue was cutting the other direction, and I think it will continue to do so and be a real problem potentially for the Republicans in 2016 because their platform still has strong opposition to same-sex marriage. And if they don't change that, they're going to lose some votes.
It's interesting. There's a parallel, I think, in Wisconsin to how President Obama initially handled the issue going into 2012, because up until that Good Morning America interview, he really wasn't very out in front. In fact, he talked about his evolving view on the subject. Just last week, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker basically said his own opinion on same-sex marriage is irrelevant. Are we almost at the point where elected officials have been able to kind of ride out the issue without taking a public stand, that it is so much in the court system now that there are some elected officials who sort of successfully, I don't know, surfed over the issue, if you will?
I think it depends whether you're a Democrat or Republican. If you're a Democrat, you have to be for same-sex marriage at this point. It's very tough to get elected statewide in any state and bring out the Democratic base if you're on the other side of that issue. If you're a Republican, as you suggest, there's a handy excuse now. You can just say it's in the courts. It's a state matter. It depends on what the voters of a state decide. It shouldn't be decided at the federal level. And there are a variety of ways of dodging it. But I think that the issue in general is cutting in the direction of the Democrats. And so even in, you know, the wow counties in Wisconsin, there are quite a number of conservative voters in those counties who also are pro same-sex marriage and potentially are open to appeals along those lines.
Interestingly, you write that the polls after President Obama gave that interview showed a majority of Americans at the time believed the president changed his public stance for political reasons. And that's an interesting parallel to the standoff over the grand bargain on the deficit, in which you describe the pretty clear role of politics versus the public good in the Republican approach to the issue.
Yeah, well, you know, both parties are playing politics a lot of the time. But I think where it really relates to Wisconsin office holders is in the case of Paul Ryan, because Paul Ryan has immense respect among the House members. And actually, Frank Luntz, the pollster, did a survey of House freshmen on who they looked to when they went into the House chamber and they saw, you know, the way a vote was going. Who did they look to for guidance? And Ryan won easily. He was much more influential than John Boehner or Eric Cantor or any of the rest of them on these House freshmen, because he had been giving a series of budget talks that both showed his command of the budget and also conveyed his basic affability and appeal for them. So the reason this is so significant is that the Ryan budget, which passed the House on several occasions, is one of the most radical documents that I've read in three decades of covering politics. And a lot of people talk about the Ryan budget, but they don't actually read it. And if you read it, it has very draconian cuts in all sorts of programs that the public supports. And these are not, you know, 5-10% cuts, which a lot of people say are long overdue. We're talking 30, 40, 50, 60% cuts, or in the case of some things, zeroing them out altogether. I went to a conference that former General McChrystal held in Gettysburg a couple of weeks ago. It was about national service and AmeriCorps, which is very popular throughout the country and in many cases saves money. Just one example, but you know, Paul Ryan's budget zeroed that out because he is philosophically opposed to these things, and you know, famously gives out copies of Ayn Rand novels in his office, and he's very much of a libertarian on many issues. So the reason that I mention this is that you had over the last 3 years, especially in 2011, 2012. A fascinating confrontation between the President of the United States and Congressman Ryan. And Obama respects Ryan's intelligence and respects him as an adversary, but they have diametrically opposed ideas of what the American social contract should be, of what we owe each other in this country. And Ryan's is more of a pre-New Deal view of America. So that was why I called my book The Center Holds, because whatever problems we have today, whatever kind of gridlock we have and polarization, if Paul Ryan had become vice president of the United States and Mitt Romney would have put him in charge of the budget, we would be living in a different country.
Well, and it's also interesting. I mean, you describe that part of Paul Ryan's rise to prominence was at least in part because President Obama took him seriously,
right,
and that vaulted him to some street cred, if you will, within the Republican Party.
Well, I think actually his street cred really came from these budget seminars that he held that most members of the House on the Republican side attended, and they were impressed by his command of the budget. The president taking him seriously helped to elevate his profile in the press, but this was really an ideological struggle, although I would say a struggle between the center-left, where Obama is, and the far-right, where Ryan, for all of his affability, is. On any kind of a consistent historical scale, and just to explain why I say that. Obamacare, for instance, which is denounced as socialism by Republicans, actually, if you look at what is in Obamacare, whether it's, you know, the particular details need to be fixed or whether they're a good idea or not, it resembles almost exactly the legislation that Republican Senators Howard Baker and Bob Dole introduced in the 1990s when Bill Clinton was trying to get big changes in our healthcare system.
Where do you see Paul Ryan on a national level today after what you describe as really the low point for the Obama presidency and after Paul Ryan's unsuccessful run for vice president? Where does this leave him now and 2 years from now?
He doesn't seem to be making noises about running for president. That could change. I think he sees himself settling in as, a very influential member of Congress, and, he'll become, in all likelihood, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee and settle in there for a while until John Boehner retires, at which point I think it'll be a very interesting vote between Paul Ryan and Kevin McCarthy to be the next speaker. I would put my money on Ryan being the next Speaker of the House.
Well, and so then in the midst of all this, people have been trying to make sense of Eric Cantor's loss in the Republican primary since it happened. Before we get to that development, though, how much of a thorn in the president's side did you see in Cantor?
I think that the president thought Cantor was smug and he irritated the president. And I have some of that in my earlier book as well. Promise. But in the center holds, I go through the various grand bargain talks, which mostly involve Boehner more than Cantor. But there was tension between the two of them. I do think that, there was an opportunity for a grand bargain, and there was a lot of blame to go around as to why it didn't happen. Obviously, now it's drifting into the past. But I think the real question coming out of Cantor's defeat is what will happen to immigration reform. And this really does, this is a point that has not been made that I've seen. It really does involve Paul Ryan, because if Republicans want to kill immigration reform out of fear of the Tea Party, that has big implications for them down the road in terms of getting the White House back. So in 2012, Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan got 29% of the Latino vote. You can't win a presidential election unless you bring that up to at least 35%, probably a little higher. And you can't do that. You can't get to 40%, the kinds of totals that you need in a country where the Hispanic population is growing very fast. You can't do that if you don't have some kind of immigration reform. And so to the extent that Cantor's loss sets back the cause of immigration reform, it's really a major defeat for the Republican Party nationally. Now, it may be that Ryan and Boehner are smart enough to kind of buck the Tea Party trend a little bit and move forward on immigration reform anyway, despite the conventional wisdom that, Cantor's loss means you shouldn't do it. It would take some political guts and foresight, but I think that they both know what I'm describing, that this is really extraordinarily important for the success of the Republican Party in the middle and long term. And so I think there's a chance that immigration reform is actually not dead. It just looks like it is right now, and that after the midterms, in order to improve their prospects in 2016, that Paul Ryan and John Boehner and Kevin McCarthy and the other Republican leaders of the House will move towards some sort of immigration reform.
How much do you think the Tea Party cares about the White House?
The Tea Party, there is no real Tea Party. It's a kind of a populist, rebellious impulse, I devote a chapter in the book to who they are. They're basically older white conservatives who are frustrated by what's happened in Washington. So would they love to have somebody who reflects their values in the White House? Yes, and I think that there will be a lot of pandering to that part of the Republican Party in the primaries. But the difference between presidential primaries and a House primary is that the turnout among Republicans is higher in presidential primaries. So you're going to get more, for lack of a better word, establishment Republicans, more traditional Republicans, who think maybe, you know, the party has moved a little too far to the right. More of them are going to be voting in those presidential primaries, which means that, you know, slightly more moderate candidates, I think, eventually will do well against Tea Party candidates. Although I'm very interested in people like Rand Paul, because I, you know, some of these candidates who sound Tea Party notes have some pretty good political chops, and, you know, might do very well in the rough and tumble of Republican primaries. The Iowa caucuses tend to be favorable for Tea Party candidates, although Terry Branstad, the Republican governor of Iowa, is now pushing back against the Tea Party and trying to make make those caucuses less right wing.
Well, and anyone listening to this is thinking to themselves, well, what does he think of Scott Walker in this conversation?
I am like everybody covering politics. I'm fascinated by Scott Walker and by his progress. I think he's if he wins this race, which is a big if, because, you know, my sense is that Mary Burke might, you know, be more formidable than some of the national reporters right now are recognizing. I think in Wisconsin, you all understand that this is a real race, but some of my colleagues in the national press are a little slow on the uptake on that. But if he survives, and especially if he wins convincingly, he sets himself up to be a strong presidential candidate. My question about him is one that's a little more cosmetic, and because cosmetics matter in, you know, optics, as to use the cliche, matter in these presidential campaigns. And I don't know whether he is charismatic enough to really shine in a kind of, you know, cattle call debate. We have, you know, seven or eight candidates up there. And I don't know whether his debating skills and his presence are enough to really make him stand out from the pack in those debates. There will be fewer of them this time than in the past, because they were harmful to the Republicans in 2012, but there still will be several. And we'll see how he does. I don't have any doubt that he wants to run. I think the mood favors a governor, and there's a lot of sense in the Republican Party nationally that some kind of a governor, maybe Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, Scott Walker, I'm not so sure about Bobby Jindal from Louisiana, but there are going to be a number of governors who are going to give it a try. John Kasich might run. So they'll be comparing their records, and I think at that point, Scott Walker's record in Wisconsin will get a lot of scrutiny. But I think that he has a lot of popularity among Republicans in other states. They've been reading about Wisconsin, and they know more about Wisconsin and what he's done there than, say, what, you know, Kasich has done in Ohio or Jindal has done in Louisiana. So he is going to be in the hunt. I just wouldn't put money on him being the nominee.
Is there a third Obama book in the works?
There is not. And that's not to say that I would rule out doing another one, but you know, both The Promise and The Center Holds were I had to write them very fast in order to get them out in a timely way. And I want to take a little bit more time with this one. I'm talking to you from the studio where we shoot Alpha House, which is the TV comedy starring John Goodman on Amazon that I'm an executive producer of. So, you know, I have other responsibilities. I'm writing for the Daily Beast, and I'm writing another history book, which I'm not quite ready to talk about yet, but it's more from the era of my first book, which was about Franklin Roosevelt. So if I circle back to Obama, it won't be for a few years yet.
Well, we'll look forward to the next book, whatever it is, and look even more forward to the next season of Alpha House.
Thanks so much, Mitch.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Jonathan Alter's latest book is called The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies, and it's just out in paperback. He spoke with Mitch Tyke. Alter is a contributing correspondent for NBC News, a writer for The Daily Beast, and executive producer of the political comedy series Alpha House, which is produced for Amazon. The first phase of what's being called a new approach to community assessment is complete, and phase two is starting. We'll talk with the project's Milwaukee organizers when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Back in February, we introduced you to a project that organizers described as a new method of community assessment. Milwaukee, along with Portland, Oregon, Richmond, Virginia, and Orlando, Florida, was selected by the University of Virginia Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture to embark on the Thriving Cities Project. Over 5 years, it will fold in a total of 10 cities. The project brought together people on Milwaukee's Northwest Side for 5 consecutive Wednesdays to discuss, quote, what it means and what it takes to thrive in Milwaukee, unquote. The Thriving Cities Project has now moved on to its next phase. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz spoke with local coordinator David Flowers and Catherine Wilson of the Zeidler Center for Public Discussion, who facilitated the conversations. They were joined by one of the participants, who we'll meet in just a few moments. Catherine Wilson began by explaining that each of the conversations dealt with a particular theme.
We started with artists, beautiful. The beautiful, yep. Which is artists and architecture. And half the crowd came late and just kind of strolled in and yes. Were very, you know, colorful group of people, colorfully dressed. And the vibe in the room was wonderful. And so each group was like that. They had their own personality. And we're talking about thriving. So that was what linked all the groups together. So they were trying to understand that word or what they saw from that word. I think each of the groups, they had some challenge to keep with the thriving and not spiral downward into discussing the challenges, the real challenges that the city faces. But we were the facilitators. We're trying to redirect, and they people were able to bring it back and really dig deep into these things. Are going well, and these things are exciting about this city, despite the challenges that are going on. So that was a special discipline for the participants across the board.
And Catherine was talking about the discipline of keeping things talking about thriving and not talking about what might be more challenging or struggles and that kind of thing. But people just kept on talking about their experiences of connecting with new people or their neighbors or with teachers or it was more relationship-oriented than I had anticipated. So I was surprised in looking at the data at the end how little reference there was made to large institutions. Every now and then they talk about the police or they talk about the governor, but 99% of the conversations were really about what's going on in the neighborhoods. So that was very surprising to me.
So were you able to bring together people who didn't necessarily know each other or didn't bump into each other all the time at the same conferences and brainstormings?
Oh, absolutely. That was one of the most exciting things and is the most exciting thing about facilitating small groups is that you see people who might never have talked to each other interact and come to some shared understanding. And whatever happens in the small group is confidential. So we can't talk specifically about the people that we met and saw as facilitators. But I was really heartened to see some of the alliances form, not just between professionals, but between community members and professionals. That was exciting for me to see those alliances.
We have the benefit of having a participant here who can talk about your experience and impression. So I'll ask you to introduce yourself.
Okay. My name is Willie Davis. I'm a pastor of Invisible Reality Ministries. I'm also a participant of the Thriving City Focus Group. So. Yeah.
Talk about your work in the community.
Working with families, with youth, actually pinpointing the abundance that's already in communities. You hear a lot about what's going on as far as violence, lack of education, high death rates, things like that, and you hear so much negative. But what was brought forward from the Zittler organization is that there is abundance. There is abundance. And there is there's life. There's life there, and we can find that. We just have to tap into the gifts and talents of those that are already presently there and be able to connect them with others as well so that we can build something.
So you were part of one of those focus groups. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. 4 or 5 sessions.
He was actually our best attendee. He gets
so, every session, you know, I gathered more and more and more information. I was able to build up more energy and take that information that I learned back to other organizations and back to the individuals within the church community and say, listen, there's something positive going on. We've been hearing every Thursday, every Wednesday night that we had those sessions, individuals saying the same thing. Had I known this was out here, or had I known that you were doing this or doing that? So it was through the communication that we were able to connect and build relationships further from there. So, but it was because of the meetings and us communicating that opened up those doors.
So you're a Milwaukee person.
Yes, I am. Been born and raised in Milwaukee, and I've seen a lot of the successes. I've also seen a lot of the terrors that we see today. But what we're doing here has created so much momentum, so much energy, that I really believe that throughout time, Milwaukee will be what we hope it to be. Very positive, welcoming community, city, that people will want to stay here. The education system, the churches, I mean, across all fields, people will want to stay here. But it has to be through this process, I believe. And this process has been so, I gained so much energy from it. And from what I can tell through the talk sessions, that people are excited. They're excited. So, and there's this renewed sense of hope.
The Thriving Cities Project is actually a 5-year program. We're trying to develop an assessment tool that cities or communities can use to measure what's going well. And that's kind of, right now we're in the second year of this project. So, you know, what will that look like? Not quite sure yet. But we're meeting in Virginia next week to present what we've come up with so far. Yeah, you know, the notion is that there's lots of ways of measuring a community's health and well-being and a city's civic life. And most of those measures that are being used now are based in what's going wrong or measuring what isn't good enough. We're trying to look at what's thriving and come up with a tool that measures where people are flourishing and what it takes to thrive. We're meeting next week. We're presenting to one another. There will be about 40 scholars from across the country, and I count myself as very lucky to be part of that, presenting this on these ideas of what it does it look like to thrive in a city and towards building a model that, you know, the mayor or various community organizations can use to identify what it is you want to you know, put your efforts into. Do you want to put it into something that's flourishing and doing well, or do you want to, you know, use the same old measures that we've been using and end up with the kind of results we've had in the past?
So when these 5 years have come to an end, there will be a model?
Any city would be able to use this model. Now, that is the long-term goal. And the participants and of our focus groups and the people who are interested in Milwaukee's thriving, obviously, you know, don't want to wait, because important things were brought up during these focus groups. So what we're doing at the Zittler Center is having a next initiative. We're having a networking fair on June 21st at Alice's Garden. It will be from noon to 3, and it is a celebration of these Thriving Cities focus groups. So it's kind of an ending or a wrap-up event to celebrate and bring people together, all the participants together, kind of co-mingle across the sectors, and also to kick off our next series. So a lot of the participants of these focus groups talked about segregation. And also in our other dialogues that we've had on poverty with the Zeidler Center, people have brought up segregation in Milwaukee as the topic that they want to talk about or the next issue that they really want to talk about. So we want to use this networking fair on the 21st as a kickoff for our series, which is called Building Thriving Community Beyond Segregation in Milwaukee. So we will be holding small group community dialogues of 15 people across Milwaukee and across sectors. So say 15 nurses, 15 police officers, all summer long. And then on August 18th, which is a Saturday, we'll have a citywide event that will include initiatives that each of these smaller community dialogues think up. So if you wanted to convene a group, if you wanted to host a group of 15 in your neighborhood, we would come in and you could brainstorm what you want for your neighborhood or your community. And the Zeidler Center will circulate all those initiatives in advance of the large group dialogue. So we're really excited about this series and hoping that we'll have a lot of people excited about it and want to convene these smaller groups throughout the summer.
And the emphasis is on listening to one another, which is kind of unique. So often, around a topic like segregation, everyone has an opinion. As soon as you say that word, everyone has an opinion. But how do you moderate, how do you guide the conversation such that people can listen to one another with respect, no matter what comes out of their mouth? Because on that topic, so many different things get spoken about. So this is a unique opportunity to listen to one another and to be listened to, which is another unique experience for so many people, to actually be able to talk without interruption and talk for a minute or two about your true beliefs on something is a unique experience, and to be actually be listened to by four other people. It's a safe process. It's all those good things, but like I say, it's a different experience than coming to a debate about a contentious subject. So, where does thriving have to? What does thriving have to do with all this? Well, I think people being able to communicate and listen to one another is kind of a bedrock foundation for where thriving comes from. To be known and to know others is kind of at the heart of the matter for me.
If we end the series with the final analysis that Milwaukee is a segregated place, for me that will be a profound waste of time, because we already know that. So we've called it, and we've worked with a planning team that represents a lot of organizations across the city, a lot of diversity. We've called it Building Thriving Community Beyond Segregation in Milwaukee, because we want to focus on what does it mean to thrive? What does it mean to confront segregation as local neighborhoods and as a city and get beyond it? So people have different ideas about segregation, about their definition of segregation. Some people bristle at the word beyond. Well, what does that mean, getting beyond something? We had to call it something.
I'm bristling over here.
but even the planning team, I mean, we've had some wonderful, we've had months of wonderful conversations. We've met every 2 weeks to discuss and mull over thriving and segregation, and we're excited about the initiatives that will arise from these small groups. We can't foresee in advance what those might be, but we know that just the experience of the dialogue process, the public conversations methodology that the Zeidler Center uses, is important and meaningful in and of itself. So we're really excited about it.
David Flowers is the local coordinator for the Thriving Cities Project. Pastor Willie B. Davis was a participant in the discussions of the project hosted earlier this year. Catherine Wilson is director of the Zeidler Center for Public Discussion. They all spoke with Susan Bentz. Organizers of the project compiled the results of the discussion series into a paper, which they'll present next week in Virginia, where the project was conceived. This weekend, the organizers will hold a barbecue and networking event at Alice's Garden on the Northwest Side. They'll also kick kick off their new series called Building Thriving Community Beyond Segregation in Milwaukee. There's more information about the project at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Well, Lake Effect essayist Mark Segrist is all for this kind of community action. In fact, he wants to see it take place all over town.
What's up, Milwaukee? I'm not talking about festivals, fish fries, or the Brewers' winning streak. I'm curious about where we're headed. The city as a whole. Our future identity, purpose, and mission. 5, 10, 15 years from now. Is there a master plan, a vision? What happened to our passion? Don't just blame leadership. Perhaps we're all guilty of lower expectations. Somehow, the bar got stuck on daily survival and weekend diversions. When was the last time you heard some real dissension in our city? Filling potholes, talk of expanding convention centers, and replacing sports venues are important. But where's the blueprint for investing in human capital? Who's promoting a bold initiative for job creation, safe streets, and diverse neighborhoods? Sure, we have our success stories. We need to build on them, to make them part of a broader stroke. Our younger minds need a reason to invest their talents here, not someplace else. Back in 1979, President Jimmy Carter said our nation was facing a crisis of confidence. Is Milwaukee now in its own period of complacency? Fiscal challenges and political discord be damned. It's time for creative thought, collaborative effort, a sense of adventure in finding our way, not just living for today. What's up, Milwaukee?
Lake Effect essayist Mark Segrist is a freelance television producer in Milwaukee whose work appears on Milwaukee Public Television and other outlets. He's currently producing a post-war documentary for MPTV entitled A Bridge to Vietnam. Segrist read us his essay, What's Up, Milwaukee? Well, it's only rock and roll, but we like it, and so does the Jewish Museum Milwaukee. We'll hear about an exhibit that celebrates Jewish contributions to that quintessential American music. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us today. What do Billy Joel, Pink, Warren Zevon, Patti Smith, Bob Dylan, the Beastie Boys, Drake, and Slash, the guy who came up with this famous guitar riff, all have in common? Well, yes, they're all pop and rock musicians, but they're also all Jewish. They, along with many others in the business, make up the exhibit Jews Who Rock that's currently installed at the Jewish Museum Milwaukee on the city's east side. Molly Dubin is the museum's curator and the one responsible for bringing the exhibit here and for expanding its coverage to include musicians, collectors, and DJs from Wisconsin. She joins me in the studio now. Molly, welcome to Lake Effect. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Bonnie. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is an exhibit that's near and dear to my heart because it's about rock and roll. And in this specific case, it's about Jews Who Rock. And let's start at the beginning. Again, no pun intended here, but the genesis of the multiple pun on that one, actually. But, you know, how did this start? Where did this idea to do this kind of exhibit begin?
Well, it's interesting. I work very closely with a group of lay leaders that help me to make decisions about the type of exhibits that we bring into our changing exhibit space. And we're always kind of looking for those unique displays and themes that can really, you know, become of interest to a large, diverse range of our community. And one of the things that's a little bit of a challenge to us on occasion is to really make that connection with kind of the younger demographic in our community. So when I came across this Jews Who Rock idea, I thought, wow, there's got to be something there that's going to appeal to everyone. There's going to be a little bit of something for everyone. And hopefully it's going to be something that is going to provide some light bulb moments as well in terms of, you know, the artists that you've known and loved and really didn't know what their background was or the traditions that have influenced them or the cultures that have influenced them. So when this came onto my radar, I thought this is something we really need to take a look at. I brought it to the committee and they just thought it was a fantastic idea.
Now, I know there's a local component to this, which we'll get to later, but this actually started on the East Coast. Somebody did the original.
It did. Yeah. I worked really closely with a woman by the name of Victoria Rayberg, who has a company by the name of National Exhibitions and Archives. And back in 2006, she had put together a show that went to a couple of venues on the East Coast, but then it really was not being utilized, and she was looking kind of for some ways to change it up and maybe get it into some other venues. And that was when I came across the information. I got in touch with Vicky, and I said, you know, I'd love to do this. Is it something that we can customize for our Milwaukee community? I always like to, you know, augment with local artifacts so it's more resonant with our community. And also, can we update it a little bit from the artists that were included when it was originally put together in 2006 and get some of those more contemporary artists in there? And she was all for it. And we just started on our journey of identifying artifacts and artists and putting together a really unique exhibit.
How far back does it go? Where do you start?
Well, it really starts kind of, certainly we go back to Tin Pan Alley, which is kind of the precursor to the birth of rock and roll. But then we really pick up kind of in the 50s when rock and roll starts to get that airtime on the radio. It was really the era of a lot of popular DJs who were instrumental, no pun intended again, in getting that new genre, the airtime that it needed to get to the greater audience. So we start there. We talk about the 50s. We go through the 60s, certainly look at some of the significant singer-songwriters, a lot of the significant events, of course, Woodstock. We get into then the 70s, 80s, 90s, the aughts, and into our contemporary times.
Right up to now.
Yeah, exactly.
When you say Jews Who Rock, it's not just the musicians, though, is it? Because you mentioned DJs, so there were some really important DJs who were Jewish.
Right. When we talk about Jews Who Rock, it's a real mix. We've got the individuals, we've got the bands, we have bands where we have some people in the group that are Jewish, but we also talk about the DJs, the promoters, the producers, and some of the inventors who were so, you know, important in creating, you know, new items that would revolutionize the music industry. So those are all part of this exploration.
Who were some of the ones that you were excited about?
Well, it's interesting. I am a bit of a trivia buff when it comes to the rock and roll genre. And so a lot of the people that were included, like the Bob Dylans and
Simon
David
Garfunkel.
Lee Roths and the Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel, Barbara Streisand, although some people will say maybe that's a little bit of a stretch in terms of the rocking, but it's also not just Jews Who Rock, it's Jews Who Rock in many respects. So we've got a lot of different people included. So some of those that we definitely expected, but then, you know, looking to people like Hillel Slovak, who was part of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Geddy Lee, who I knew was Jewish, Geddy Lee of Rush, but didn't know that his parents were Polish immigrants and Holocaust survivors. So some of those pieces of information, Gene Simmons, born as Chaim Witz in Haifa, Israel.
And see, that I didn't know. When I saw that, I thought, okay, that was a surprise. Yeah.
So it was things like that, kind of the, you know, a bit of the information in the background. I knew some of our local, you know, inclusions like Howie Epstein, who was the bassist for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, but it gave me an opportunity to really, you know, get in touch with the family and learn a lot more about his background and his contributions to the band. Certainly some of the more metal genre, like the Dee Snyders, the David Adlers, who was a drummer at one time for Guns N' Roses, Slash, who of course was involved with Guns N' Roses, born Paul Hudson. And that's one of the other interesting pieces we explore is if their born name was something different than their stage name, which of course isn't unusual for artists and performers, but some of them were so much a part of their Jewish culture and background that it was interesting to learn what those birth names were.
As you look at all of the artifacts and you look at the research and you consider it, you know, what does it tell you about the place of Jews in American rock and roll? I mean, obviously important. Did it change it in any way? Would it have been a different thing without Jewish influence?
You know, it's interesting. Jewish individuals are so prevalent in the music business and in the entertainment business in general. And I think that has a lot to do with the timing as well, in terms of when the music business and the entertainment business came into being, when a lot of the new technologies were developed. When that came about, it was kind of a new industry. And whereas with some of the existing careers, often Jews were excluded, couldn't, you know, find employment, or there were quotas on the number of Jews who could be included. Because this was a new genre and a new industry, it really gave Jewish individuals an opportunity to really get involved on the ground floor and to become a significant part of the foundation of the building of rock and roll. But also in terms of the fact that Jews have always been, in one form or another, looked at as outsiders in different communities, certainly looking back to the diaspora. And when you think about rock and roll heroes, they're often looked at as rebels or outsiders who are, you know, not necessarily going with the status quo. So to make that connection between Jewish individuals and kind of the rock rebels isn't that far of a stretch. It really isn't.
I also think, too, that rock and roll kind of belongs to everybody. And so I Absolutely. Think there's probably a lot of non-Jews who might look at some of these names and think, oh, I had no idea, but it doesn't really matter to me what they are.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons we really wanted to bring this exhibit here is because there's something for everyone. You know, it really is so resonant to so many people, so many age groups, people from all kinds of backgrounds. And it's nice to have that unifying subject that can bring people together to celebrate something that everyone is so enthusiastic about and has influenced their lives in one way or another. Everyone knows the soundtracks to their lives and who those artists are. And it doesn't matter what their religion is, what their cultural background is. It just is a part of the soundtrack for their lives. And that's what the significance is.
So talk a little bit more about the local aspect, what you were able to add here, other than Howie. I mean, Howie Epstein is probably the most famous person coming out of Milwaukee that way, but obviously there are others.
Absolutely. A lot of interesting connections. Collection-wise, we have a lot of great collectors here in town. So actually, one of our co-chairs, Kevin Kinney, has a fantastic record album collection, album covers. And so I went to his home, and it was really hard to pick. I mean, hundreds and hundreds, but we kind of looked at some of the musicians who were in the show or maybe some of the interesting connections and made some selections that way. I was also put in touch with Rick Kohlmeyer, who was one of the concert photographers for Summerfest in Alpine Valley for more than 30 years, who has this incredible, you know, documentary photographic collection. So I was able to go to his home and, you know, pick up pictures of Steely Dan and Pink and Warren Zevon and Slash and Patti Smith and Billy Joel and the Jay Giles Band. And it just goes on and on. And so to be able to make those kind of, you know, local connections was really great. We also were able to connect with a gentleman by the name of Michael Kohler, who's a local music producer. He works with some pretty large name clients, but he works exclusively with Moog equipment. And Bob Moog was the inventor of the Moog Mini Voyager synthesizer. So, of course, the synthesizer really revolutionized the rock and music, you know, genre in general beyond Phil Spector's wall of sound. I mean, we can't imagine what music would have been like without the introduction of the synthesizer. We also talk a little bit about Ben Sidran, who was born in Chicago but raised here in the Racine area and was part of the original Steve Miller Band. But of course, he went on to be a recording artist in his own right, a jazz musician, an author. So that's another piece. The other individual we included was Lee Rothman, who was a very prominent DJ. So he was at WRIT from the late 50s to the late 60s, which is this very key time in getting the rock and roll that playtime. And he was meeting and getting to interview all of the artists and musicians of the day. So we were able to get some great photographs of Lee with the likes of, you know, Chubby Checker and Mick Jagger. And it just goes on. So to be able to make those local connections was really, really nice.
I know you got this from Victoria on the East Coast, but are you able to continue it out in the world somewhere?
You know, people have asked that, and maybe that's something I need to kind of explore with Victoria, because the additions that we've made have really made it, you know, a richer experience, particularly for the Milwaukee community. But there are things that could travel, you know, if this exhibit was to go on to other venues, and the additions that we've made, the inclusion of some of the more contemporary artists, were to make it, you know, more attractive for other venues around the country. That's something we could explore and look at the possibility of making some of those artifacts available to other venues.
It also sounds like there are enough here between the collectors and just the history that you could have a permanent little collection.
You could have a permanent collection. And as you said earlier, it's, you know, music is such a unifying idea and subject. And so to be able to have something like that, that really gets something for everyone, it's not a bad thing to have in a permanent capacity.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot. Your favorite piece.
Oh, that's hard to pick. There's a really terrific photograph, I'd have to say, that probably is something that just blew me away when I saw it. It's a black and white photograph of a very young Bob Dylan, who looks to be about 15, but sharing a bowl of Quaker puffed oats with beat poet Allen Ginsberg and LSD guru Timothy Leary and Child, who is sitting on his lap. And it's just this incredible moment in history. And it just seems so, you know, kind of voyeuristic and casual, but obviously kind of a significant meeting of the minds. So that's one of my favorite pieces in the show. One of the other things that you might want to take a look at is an exhibit that we have of children's work. We were able to work with Arts at Large with 53rd Street School, and they were given the challenge of creating LP. They were given actual records that
album
they could
covers.
Design. Right, album, the actual albums and album covers. And they could design a piece and research either Pink, Mac Miller, Adam Levine of Maroon 5, or Drake. And they were asked to design the piece and then do a little research and write a statement about that artist's Jewish influence or, you know, how it was a part of their life. And we have that up in the hallway, so that's a great piece. We also put together, with our education director, Ellie Gettinger, who I have to give a shout-out to, a Jews Who Rock playlist on Spotify, which is a great playlist. So if you have Spotify or you can download that app, get the Jews Who Rock playlist, and it's a great opportunity to rock out.
Well, Molly, it has been such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thanks, Bonnie. It's been a pleasure.
Molly Dubin is the curator for the Jewish Museum Milwaukee and for its current exhibit, Jews Who Rock, 60 Years of Jews in Rock and Roll. It's open through August 10th. And as we go out with the succinctly named Multilateral Nuclear Disarmament by the Beastie Boys, I'm Bonnie North, thanking you again, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.